Succession number 28355, reel 17.
You were telling me the story of the laptop.
The laptop was lost, in the, as I explained. It wasn't clear. We got the papers back. It clearly wasn't a sting by some Iraqi secret service or something like that. It was, I think, purely a thief. But we hadn't got the laptop back, and of course, what was on the hard drive, because I think the whole of the PowerPoint, or the equivalent of it, wasn't PowerPoint in those days, the whole of the script and the presentation was somewhere in that laptop. Wasn't accessible. How expert did you have to be accessible? So we decided we would take a bit of time just to work out just what somebody who had got it would actually be able to access before we started talking to the Americans about it. Eventually, obviously, we had to tell the Americans what had happened. And Paddy Hine went out to see Schwarzkopf. There was a step in this, though, which speeded it up rather, because all this happened sort of mid-December time, or late December. The 20th of December. So we decided we'd examine what we would know. And then I was up in Norfolk over the Christmas break, and we had information on, I think, the 29th, an urgent call from Dick Vince and the Mail on Sunday and other media were going to print the story about the laptop. We needed secure communications, but it was easier for Dick Vincent, who was in London, than for me from Norfolk. So Dick actually rang Colin Powell, and Paddy Hine went out to see Schwarzkopf. Because what we had talked about was, what the Americans were planning, the coalition was planning to do. So Prime Minister had been briefed on this. And the concern, obviously, was to know whether the Iraqis would have got hold. And we eventually came to the conclusion the Iraqis wouldn't. And the laptop itself was handed back sometime later. But there was, an awkward period. But fortunately, both Schwarzkopf and the Americans in Washington took it pretty well in their stride. I didn't feel, from what we knew, and we could tell them that there hadn't been any breach of security, serious in the sense of the Iraqis getting to hear about it. Mind you, in other ways, we were beginning to signal what we were going to do fairly loudly anyway, so the difference between what we tell the Prime Minister and what the public were getting, or likely to get in the next few days, and therefore the Iraqis, wasn't so far apart.
So you arrive at Christmas, really, now?
Well, through Christmas.
Okay.
Tom King was away, but I had some difficulty with Archie Hamilton then, who was standing in. And this is back to the carrier. I think he was discuss the latest CBS mission with MinAF, that was Archie Hamilton, who agreed to inform the War Cabinet, and then subsequently under OMB, that's the finance branch's pressure, reneged a bit. Also said he thought the operational case was weak. And I told him bluntly, the operators and commanders all judge it strong and he should stick to political judgments. So you know, I was having some difficulty with MinAF too. And he also said 12 million is a bit much. I think I mentioned that we need to spend some money to upgrade the carrier. We're now in December, end of December, you know, it's been mumbling on. And I had to point out the ministers were looking at price tickets, we shouldn't be going to war. So there we are. There was then Schwarzkopf would like to wait until he was ready. Remember, he got still getting his third division out there, and his attitude very strongly. I only get one shot at this. I don't want to do it till I'm right and ready. And the politicians, of course, getting anxious that they needed to see action. So there was a tension between must get on with it. Because I think by this time, all hope of any diplomatic
solution
had expired. There were one or two last-ditch attempts at it. But you know, and the political mindset now was we're going to have to go to war. And therefore they wanted to get on with it. Schwarzkopf, quite rightly, didn't want to get on till he got all his ducks in a row. But by this time I was glad to record that Schwarzkopf confirmed that he had to get Washington's political approval for the campaign, even if he had first used aircraft in response to any Iraqi preemption. So by now, at long last, he is sort of
addressing
it as I would want. So, turning over, looking for the next highlighted bit.
Of course, it would really have been General Powell who should have been looking for the overall political objectives being settled.
Yes, when I say Schwarzkopf, and Schwarzkopf was talking to Powell all the time, so if I represented Schwarzkopf clearly.
The
mechanics would have been through Cullen. I didn't mean to imply that Schwarzkopf got it straight from Bush. Tenth of January, PM had been out to the Gulf. He'd enjoyed it. Had a long session with him and Tom King then on date selection. And PM and Bush had obviously had a chat about it, and I then had a chat with Colin Powell. We agreed that the Air and Navy were up and ready, but needed to extend the air campaign until the ground forces were fully ready on the 10th of February. It says here, and the main concern is, as I think I mentioned, Douglas Hurd had touched on it, is can world opinion be held for a protracted air campaign if necessary because the Iraqis haven't surrendered under the air onslaught. But the PM stresses politics of waiting untenable. So there we were, we're between the rock and the hard place. And the fix was really to run the air campaign rather longer. As it happened, the weather wasn't that good. And then, of course, the Scuds attacking Israel, you know, turned, sidestepped, or at least diverted the attention of the air operation quite considerably for a while. So in the end, it sort of it worked out fairly all right.
So extending the air campaign in a way was a device, I know partly required by the weather and so on, but was partly a device to enable the ground forces to get absolutely
the ground forces weren't going to be ready, according to this, till the 10th of February. I'm not sure exactly, but that's what I've got down here. And I can't remember when the actual date when the ground forces did go in. But I'll probably come across in a moment. But the weather one needed 3 whole weeks of an air campaign, both in terms of the number of targets you could hit or go on hitting. I mean, there's a finite number of targets you want to hit. And assuming you're hitting them reasonably successfully and don't have to go back and re-hit them, 3 weeks was going to be quite generous. But, politicians weren't happy not to get started in mid 15th, 16th of January, whatever it was, with 3 weeks away from the 10th of February. So that was sort of one of the issues there that was eventually resolved itself to a certain extent, and that the air campaign didn't run through its targets as originally suggested. It probably would have taken less than 3 weeks because they had the other things to do, and the weather also made life a bit more difficult.
So it was really in that long chat with Colin Powell that you settled the outline dates, really.
Yes, I mean the Schwarzkopf called the 10th of February, fine, because that was when he felt he'd got his ground forces in position. You know, he was going to do the U.S. Marines sort of right hook, but the real main effort was going to invade Iraq to the left of Kuwait and to a right hook, left hook round into behind Kuwait and cut off Republican Guard forces, which were either in Kuwait or dug in on the Kuwait-Iraqi border. So now, under political pressure to get on with it, under the 10th of February as the sort of get started for the ground forces, the rest sort of, planned itself or fitted itself in. Secretary General of the United Nations went out in 11th of January and got nowhere with Saddam. And the Prime Minister, Saul Baker, even then I was still not quite clear whether we were having a joint decision or whether we were just going to say yes, sir, if the Americans made up their mind. And I need to give the joint commander the date, time, group for hostilities and Saudi government agreement, because we were going to operate from Saudi things.
Do you want me to stop
from there? 15th of January, last day of the United Nations deadline. Early briefings before going to OPDG. Main issues were terrorism, including hotels in Bahrain. We're afraid our troops, our air crew were in hotels in Bahrain. US-UK talks and a joint decision with the Saudis. PM slightly put it out by my insistence on prior government-to-government clearance, but agreed. In other words, I want to be quite clear that HMG had agreed and it was a government-to-government agreement. But eventually I got it there on the 15th of January. Um, We would be given 24 hours notice, and this was accepted by the US. French initiative caused a lot of irritation. It was not mentioned to PM by Mitterrand yesterday. I've mentioned earlier my problems with Schmidt, and the French, I don't know what their, I can't remember what their initiative was, but clearly John Major had been out in Paris, or seeing Mitterrand, only the day before on the 14th of January, and whatever it was the French got up to. I think this was some wheeze with Saddam, and I can't remember what it was, but clearly irritated John Major no end that Mitterrand had not mentioned it to him. Right, moving on. And then we got started on the 16th, 8:15. Tonkin came into my office to say the president had spoken to the PM last night. We were on for midnight, that's the 16th, 17th. And I told Paddy Hine, and later on the day, Tonkin gave me a written minute, which I used to authorise Paddy sending my car, the points I'm making on your own. Saw the Prime Minister a brief on the tornado raids.
Can you say it again? You did what?
So I saw the Prime Minister to brief him on what the tornadoes, because on that first wave we were going to have some tornadoes going in, and so I wanted the Prime Minister to be clear that he knew that we were involved, and this was the scale of it. Obviously he wanted to know too, and should know. So I went over to give him a briefing on that. I'd had the night of the 16th. As I say, I was close to the chest, we'd held this. We occasionally, or fairly regularly, had Chiefs of Staff suppers together, hosted by one or other. And this particular occasion on the 16th had been programmed that CS would be hosting us. At 11:30 I told them the war would be on in 30 minutes. And it was, must say, watching CNN a little later that night, seeing live voice coverage from Baghdad. Amazing listening and hearing about presumably the F-117As, that's the stealth fighter, attacks going in against ineffectual anti-aircraft things. So there I was in my flat watching CNN as the first authoritative indication that the war had actually started, although I knew it was on. So,
what was the chief's reaction to being told so late that?
No, I think that was.
They were quite happy.
No, I mean, there was nothing. They were not. There was nothing they could do. There was no need for them to be aware. We were security conscious. They were quite happy about that. At least I've never heard anyone complaining to me later. What the hell didn't they tell me sooner? I didn't know till 12 hours before that was go. So I knew I was going to see them. I didn't want to tell A and not B. And if I called them all into my office sometime in the morning, the buzz would have gone round. It was much better to do it when I had them captive without staff and underlings. Whether it was worth starting the dinner with it or finishing the dinner with it, you can have a. And of course, we started to lose a few aircraft, which caused a certain amount of worry. I don't think you'd know. The rest, as I say, is rather history, because it's on the media, briefings and so on are going on. I don't think I've got anything. I mean, we had a very good relationship going with Schwarzkopf. and he and LeBee got on well. Very important. Bill Grattan was in with the air commander, so on the American side. So there was a good relationship there. So I don't think I've got anything I want to...
You're whistling through your pages here. Are you saying that... because the war was very short. It was 3 or 4 weeks of air war, wasn't it? And 72 to 96 hours of land.
Yeah, 100 hours. Yes.
100 hours, that's it, 100 hours. Are you saying then that really the hard work...
There were daily or almost daily war cabinet meetings, and I would brief the war cabinet on what had happened in the last 24 hours or since the last time we'd met. You know, and I had a war chart and showed them on that where we got to. And so, you know, there was a running commentary from me briefing ministers. Well, I don't think I need to go through that blow by blow. You know, it was what everybody knows happened now.
Yes.
So, I mean, that was the pattern. And after, you know, if anything came out of those war cabinet meetings, I almost invariably had a chiefs of staff meeting immediately afterwards so that I could debrief them on what had happened in the cabinet meeting, and if we needed to get on with something, you know, we could get on with it. So that was the sort of pattern of activity. And followed through along with media briefings and so on. I did a number of media briefings. Eventually got Tom King to agree I could do them on my own. At one stage he got rather concerned that a light blue uniform was doing it, and somebody told him he ought to have a khaki or a black blue one. I said, get lost, you know, I'm with the Chief of Defence stuff. But you know, you know, you may well laugh, but these were some of the sort of issues one had to deal with.
But that's a case of Tom King literally getting the colour of the uniform question completely. Getting involved with the minutiae, which he shouldn't have done.
I was CDS as an RAF officer. The joint commander in this case was Paddy Hine, an Air Force officer. And for a long time we'd had Sandy Wilson before Peter Labilia came in as the Airmanite and the overall charge in the Gulf. And as I pointed out to Tom King, Paddy Hine had been VCDS before he went to High Wycombe. He was very purple, and the fact that he happened to be in a light blue uniform was a ridiculous way of judging it. I was CDS. I wasn't wearing a light blue uniform. I mean, I wasn't in a light blue post. I was in a... And I took offence, actually, at being my integrity and sense of duty to the job I was filling. Of course, if I was CAS, I would be expected to argue for, as a good advocate for my service. But I'm not the advocate for my service when I'm CDS. I'm the advocate for the services. Paddy Hine had plenty of experience as a purple officer when he was at High Wycombe, and so on. You know, it was a ridiculous way of seeing it. But occasionally people do see it. I mean, to this day, people get excited about the colours of uniform. I think they ought to think, what's the job the chap's doing? Is he fulfilling the job correctly? Not judge him by, you know, the fact whether he's wearing a tie or not. And learn the colour of the uniform he's wearing. You know. Right. How are we doing? I think. Yes, I know.
So you never came under what one might call goose green pressure. The politicians didn't suddenly decide halfway through the air war, oh, we don't think it's going quite right, or there's some problem, you've got to do something.
You never came
under that sort of pressure.
No. I mean, there was almost too much going on. I think the concern was, you know, things that shouldn't be hit were getting hit. Remember the bunker?
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact, but I think there was a Saddam headquarters but it was peopled over with women and children, and a lot of them got killed. You know, so there were political concerns about the perceptions of the way the air warfare was going from that point of view. That was the media pressure and the politicians having to deal with it. The other difficulty with media, of course, was the live microphone in Riyadh and in Washington and in London. You know, you get asked a question, and where you're being, again, I think I've rehearsed this with you before, where you're getting the story coming out the same way. Now it's called spin and so on, but you know, just getting the points across that you wanted to, and not being appearing to be contradicting each other. And then the third issue, and CNN comes up and says, you know, three tornadoes have been shot down. Well, you know you've lost one, you might have lost two, but you don't know about the third. Do you believe CNN, or do you wait to hear from your own sources? And you can't turn around and say CNN got it ballsed up, because you're not actually certain yourself. And anyway, you may not want to say CNN got it ballsed up. So you've got media handling. I mean, we've learnt a lot from the Falklands, as I think I mentioned earlier. We learnt a lot more here, and we're still learning about the handling of media, and making sure that, particularly with this sort of global coverage, that the story, not the story in the sense of the tale, but the story in the terms of the facts, are coming out with equal exactitude in any of the places that you may get asked. And it's, you know, I think, as I think I mentioned before, Brian Burridge did very well on that this time round. And you've got to get the personalities who are doing it right too, because the media react much better than they did, say, to poor old McDonald in the Hawkins. So I think we can flash on through much of this. Scuds we've talked about.
That must have caused a political difficulty, or not?
Scuds?
Yes.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I was given very clear instructions. We mustn't be seen to give the Israelis any help whatsoever. And it was really down to the Americans to persuade the Israelis, you know, to wind in their necks and not for the Americans to persuade the Israelis not to get involved.
Greatly complicated matters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would have been...
We've probably broken the Arab side of the coalition.
Yeah. Because up till now, of course, Saddam has been isolated in the Arab world.
Yes.
So there we are, and the war was over very quickly. I flew out there 48 hours after it was over.
Were you surprised at the speed the whole thing was over in 5 weeks, or whatever it was?
No, I think I'd recorded somewhere here that I'd given Easter, before Easter, and I suppose Easter must have been early April, and we finished, yes, a good bit before that. I thought the Iraqi ground forces would put up a bigger fight when it was their country that we were actually in. I didn't see them necessarily fighting very strongly for Kuwait. But I thought, as erroneously as it happened, that they might put up a stiffer response when it was actually on their own territory. But they didn't. We had a fair bit of difficulty in getting battle damage assessments right, because I think there was rather more optimism at times coming out of Riyadh, and the overhead photography appeared to show Cassandra's, although he too had that, so there was a sort of spin on how things were going as well, I think, which is inevitable, I think, but I'm not critical about it, but one doesn't want to sort of say it's going terribly slowly and badly and I'm making absolute all excited. I'm bound to sound a bit more positive than that. Anyway, so the war was over, and
there's no comment you'd like to make at all about the 4 days of ground war. Nothing.
No,
I sticks in your mind.
I mean, I did go to just trying to remember when the ground war actually. Sorry, what the date was. You switch off for a moment.